difficult. If there are any questions about anything that I'm saying, feel free to just yell at me. Any questions about anything, I'll be more than happy to answer things as I go along. Especially if you can't read what I've written, or you've forgotten what I've said, and still can't read what I've written, because my writing is uniformly terrible. So the aims of my talk are fourfold. One aim is just to define what a variety is. The second goal is to compare varieties to manifolds. And the third goal is just to convince you that they're better than manifolds. And then fourth and finally, I'll talk about some moduli problems. I'll say what that means, and I'll say why this means. I'll say why this means that varieties are better than manifolds as well. So this is really a subsection of four. Okay. So algebraic geometry is a huge field, way too big to say almost anything about almost any of it. So instead, I'm going to focus on varieties. Now, algebraic geometry is famous for being sort of very arcane, and there's lots of technology that you need to set up to really do some work. But the ideas that it's all based on and where it all started are very simple. Kind of the reason that I like them is because varieties are sort of the simplest geometric objects you can think of. And yet they're also, almost any geometric object you can think of really is a variety. And they still manage to be more general than manifolds in some ways. So, I'm going to start with some motivation. So, differential geometry is sort of the study of manifolds. And by manifolds, I mean smooth manifolds. So, we know that a manifold is what you get when you glue together open subsets of Euclidean space in such a way that your transition functions are smooth. So, it's something that locally looks like R to the n. And it's also something with a smooth structure. So it's something we can do analysis on. But the problem with that is, well, even continuous functions are certainly too general. On a manifold, we don't care about the continuous functions, we care about the smooth functions. And yet if I ask you, what does a continuous function look like? I guarantee the picture you will have in your head is something along the lines of this, which is actually a smooth function. Right? Continuous functions, when we try and study continuous functions, this is topology, but the problem is we can't say very much about them because our idea of what a continuous function is wrong. Our idea of a continuous function is really our idea of a smooth function. There's almost no chance that any of you pictured sort of examples of horrible continuous functions which do exist. There's the viscous function, which is a function that's continuous everywhere, but differentiable nowhere. So this is a continuous function. This is something that topologists claim to care about, but you can't picture it, you can't write it down. The best you can do is write it down as some sort of limiting process, but you can't get your hands on what this function actually is. This is true of continuous functions. This is still true of smooth functions. There are plenty of smooth functions like this that I can sort of picture it, I can say what it looks like, but most smooth functions I can't write down explicitly a formula for them, which is a shame. So instead of looking at continuous functions and instead of looking at smooth functions, what algebraic geometers do is they look at algebraic functions, in other words, polynomials. Right? Polynomials, you know exactly what a polynomial looks like, and better than that, you can write down what any polynomial is. So not only can I give you examples of them, but any polynomial, you can know exactly what it looks like, which is just not true of smooth functions. So this is why we should sort of care about algebraic geometry as opposed to differential geometry. By switching to algebraic geometry, we lose the analytic tools, but we gain a whole host of algebraic tools that we get because we know exactly what all other functions look like and we can write down what they are. So, start with definition. Let K be a field, and it can be any field you like. This is one of the benefits of algebraic geometry, is that you can use any field, which is why it has so many applications. You don't just have to use the real numbers. Maybe if you're doing complex manifolds, you can look at the complex numbers. But the point is, for any field, we define affine n-space in the fancy A to just mean n copies of K, so it's just the points x1, xn with xi, a point in K. This is sort of our basic object that we start with in the same way that Euclidean space is what we start with, manifolds. We then say a subset of An is closed if there exist polynomials with coefficients in K and with n variables, such that X is the common set of vanishing of all of these polynomials, i.e., the set of points such that all of the polynomials vanish at once. So this is what a closed subset of affine n-space is. So I've said this is a closed subset. And in fact, this defines a topology on affine n-space, which is very different to the normal topology, where all of my closed subsets are really just things cut out by some number of polynomials. So it's not too hard to show this topology, but I'm not going to do it. I'm just going to say that this does define one. And given this, an affine variety is now just a closed set in our new topology. Object is an open subset of Euclidean space. But again, even an open subset of Euclidean space, we know it's some sort of union of pools, but we have no idea what it looks like in general. In algebraic geometry, our basic object is an affine variety, which is a closed subset of affine space. But the nice thing is, we know exactly what this looks like. We know that there are some polynomials somewhere, such that the set of points where they will vanish exactly describes our variety. So, before we do some examples, I just want to say the set of regular functions, where the regular functions on an affine variety are the analog of our smooth functions on our manifold. So the regular functions on V, which are at K of V, is the set of functions f from v into our field k, where there are some polynomial k variables in n variables, such that f of x is p of x. What am I saying? I'm saying the functions that we're interested in looking at on our variety are really just the polynomials. So with manifolds, we're interested in smooth functions into the real numbers, and we're interested in the smooth functions between manifolds. For varieties, we don't care about smooth functions. Smooth functions doesn't really mean very much. We just care about the algebraic functions, the polynomial maps between our two manifolds. So this is great, because now if I have a variety, I can tell you exactly what every regular function on that variety looks like. I can just write it down explicitly, and since I know how polynomials behave, I have a really good handle on what the functions of my variety look like, which is incredibly useful. And in fact, one of the first things you do in any algebraic geometry course is explicitly write down what the regular functions are as an algebraic object. And there are some really great interactions. You can describe all the functions. You can describe describe regular maps between varieties in terms of maps of rings between smooth regular functions between varieties. They're really, really, in some sense, a variety is exactly determined by its regular functions. And you can get a lot of mileage out of that equivalence. But again, that's not really the topic.
You don't happen to care if the variety is irreducible or not?
No, so I'm not particularly bothered if a variety is irreducible. I am very inclusive. So irreducible means this is actually a good point. So first things first. So the variety has a topology. It's the subspace topology of affine n space. Interesting fact about affine varieties. Well, first of all, an interesting fact about affine n space is that you can show that it's compact. Rn is definitely not compact with the usual topology. We know that by Heine-Borel theorem, the compact subsets are those that are closed and bounded. Whereas, in fact, in affine n-space, any closed subset is compact, including the whole space. So that's quite useful. That's one way in which varieties are not the same as the manifolds we're used to looking at. Another slightly weirder thing is that no affine variety is Hausdorff. This is something that takes a little bit to show, but in fact, it's just not possible to separate things in terms of open sets. This is because the closed sets, we have far fewer closed sets in our algebraic topology than we do in our regular Euclidean topology. But another interesting property that we care about in varieties is we say a variety is irreducible. If we can write V as a finite union of subvarieties, i.e. closed subsets, then one of the subsets is actually equal to V. So we can't decompose our varieties into the union of two closed subsets. That's what it means to be irreducible. So this is something that will be useful later. So there we go. We know what a variety is. We know what it is. It has a topology on it, so we can really say it's a geometric object. But we know exactly what the closed sets are, and we can write them all down explicitly, which is something that is really very useful when we're trying to do things with them. So now we're going to move on to part two of my talk, which is to compare the manifolds. I'm going to start by playing a game. I'm going to play a game called Everything is a Variety. How it works is you tell me a manifold, and I tell you why it's a variety. So can someone name a manifold? Any manifold. What is a manifold? Give me a manifold.
CPN.
CPN is complex projective space. So it's really everything is a variety star, meaning almost everything is a variety. CPN is something I'll talk about later. CPN is a variety almost more or less by definition. What CPN is CPN is in fact a moduli space for the set of lines in a vector space of dimension n plus 1. I'll get to that later. Give me another manifold.
The graph of a smooth function.
Graph of a smooth function. Okay.
One that's not a polynomial.
One that's not a polynomial? Sure. So let's take, say, sine of x, right? I'm convinced that sine of x is not a polynomial. Well, it has infinitely many roots, so it can't be a polynomial. So sine of x, this is the graph of a function, but this is a set. So it's not a manifold, it's a set. It's a manifold once you give it a smooth structure. Once you give it a smooth structure, it's a line. graph of a smooth function will end up being diffeomorphic to a line once we endowed with the manifold. A line is most definitely just a fine one space. So I'm happy that this is a variety. What other manifolds do we have?
A torus.
A torus. A torus is one of the better varieties, in fact. So a torus looks like this when you think of it as a real manifold. A torus really is a variety. If we take K to be C, this is something I'll come back to later. This is, in fact, one of my examples of a variety. And we take the polynomial f of x is y squared minus x cubed plus ax plus b. For any complex numbers a and b, this gives us a torus. So a torus is a variety. I'm going to start naming some other things. I'm going to name the sphere Sn. This is easy, right? This is the sum of the coordinate functions squared is equal to 1. So this is the same as saying the polynomial sum of my coordinate functions and take 1 off vanishes.
Rn plus 1.
So my point is, sort of any manifold you can reasonably think of, most manifolds you can reasonably think of can be viewed as varieties. And yet, there are more things that are varieties than manifolds. So if there definitely are manifolds which aren't varieties, but sort of if we can't name any, if we can't picture any, how much do we care about them? Any more manifolds? No more manifolds?
What about like the V groups? I mean, are there bad ones? Like, if I pick like a, what's the norm? Like the metaplectic group or whatever? Does that one do that?
I have no idea what that is.
It's some
mostly
double
groups.
Metaplectic groups, so.
When I say mostly groups, I mean all the Lie groups I'm going to talk about, which are none of them which we just said this. Mostly groups are really subsets of matrices.
Yeah.
Right? So we can view a matrix. Well, a matrix looks like an n by n matrix looks like an element of A to the n squared, right? Because we have n squared coordinates. So one Lie group is the general linear group, which is a group of invertible matrices. GL. Let's say of K to the n. So this is the group of invertible matrices, and it sits inside A of n squared. But it is exactly the matrices in A n squared that have non-vanishing determinant. We know by linear algebra that the determinant of a matrix is just a polynomial in terms of the coefficients. So GLNK is A n squared. It's the complement of the points where the determinant vanishes. So the points where the determinant vanishes an affine variety, it's a closed subset. So that means the general linear group is an open subset of affine n space. I haven't quite defined what a general variety is yet, but it turns out that this really is a variety. A general variety is something you can form by gluing together a whole bunch of affine varieties. And in fact, the complement of the vanishing of one polynomial is sort of the most standard example of how you show that open subsets of affine space are varieties. Because I can give this, I can give you a homeomorphism from this into another variety. In fact, I can look at this as the set of points in a n squared times cross k, x, y, where the determinant of x times y is 1. this set is exactly the points where the determinant doesn't vanish. So if I have a point x where the determinant doesn't vanish, then there's a unique y such that this equation is satisfied. So there's a unique point in here, which really is a closed subset of this affine n squared plus 1 space that corresponds to it. So here we get a homeomorphism of topological spaces between this open subset of affine space and this closed subset of affine space. So it really is a variety. More generally, any open subset of affine space is going to be a variety, and more generally than that, a general variety is something which can be glued together by affine varieties, in the same way that a manifold is glued together by open subsets. And the fact that various matrix groups really are varieties gives you some really good tools to prove things about linear algebra, which I'll talk about a bit later when I come to modular. So here we saw that all the manifolds we could name were varieties. So let's name some more varieties. We saw the sphere, so that includes the circle. So the circle was, we take our field to be the real numbers, we take one polynomial, and we take the polynomial x squared plus y squared minus 1, and we're looking in r squared. This was the circle. If we again take k to be the real numbers, f to be the same polynomial, but now look in r cubed, what's this?
Cylinder.
Right, because for any z, it doesn't matter what z we choose. For any value of z, we're just looking at the point such that x squared plus y squared is 1. So if you take r cubed, and if you take any logical slice with constant z, you just get a circle. So really what we've got is we've got a family of circles just moving up in a straight line. So I could have written maybe more interesting things down, and we'd have gotten a more interesting family of circles. For example, we could have circles that are like a tilted cylinder. It's also a variety. My third example. Take K to be any field. Take a polynomial f of x1 up to xn to be the sum from I1 to n lambda I xi, where lambda I is just a point in k, and look at this as a subset of affine n space. What's the variety determined by the vanishing of this? The kernel of what?
The linear transformation.
Yeah, so this is exactly the set of points such, so this is exactly a linear functional on affine n space. So the set of zeros of this is exactly the things in the kernel of the linear map from Km to K, given by matrix, which one am I writing matrices? Number one. Under K. So it's the kernel of the linear map from K into K. So this is an n minus 1 dimensional linear subspace of Kn. So this is just a vector subspace of dimension n minus 1. So any vector subspace of any vector space is really just a variety. So you can do anything you want to do in linear algebra just by doing it in algebraic time. Let's do one more. Well, I did the torus over there, so I'll draw some pictures of the torus in a minute. So let's have my final example being k is cubed, go to rational numbers, zip to them. What's this?
No.
Is this helping? Okay. So f of x, it does exist. So it exists, it's the empty set.
Okay.
Why is it the empty set?
Because those rational numbers don't exist.
Or these rational numbers don't exist?
Unless someone else thought that there was something else wrong.
I mean, you're right. No, it
yeah.
is the empty set. But to prove that it's the empty set is quite hard. Andrew Wiles did it about 15 years ago because the set of solutions to this equation are the set of solutions to the equation x to the n plus y to the n is z to the n. For n greater than 3, the fact that there are no solutions to this equation is Fermi's last theorem. So this is the empty set. If you can prove that it's the empty set, well done you. this is kind of one of the good things about algebraic geometry is that although it's really geometry, if you use different fields, you can have huge applications to number theory. And in fact, the proof of Fermi's last theorem given by Wiles was exactly using algebraic geometric methods. So perhaps something useful to say is that obviously these here I gave the same polynomial but in different spaces and we got different varieties. I can write down the same polynomial and I can choose different fields and I'll also get different varieties. For example, if I were to write down x squared plus y squared plus 1, if I look at this in r squared, what's the variety determined by this polynomial? The empty set. Because for any real number, the square of real number is positive, so this is always going to be positive, so we can't solve x squared plus y squared plus 1 is 0. But as soon as we think of this as the same polynomial lying inside of the complex numbers, now we have a whole bunch of solutions. We have a whole family of them. In fact, if you give me any number z and say, well, I want a solution with x is z, then I have to solve the equation y squared is 1 minus z squared. And I can most certainly do this over the complex numbers. In fact, I get two solutions. So over the real numbers, this variety is the empty set. Over the complex numbers, it's some interesting thing. So I said I get two solutions. Do I always get two solutions for any z? If I set z to be 1 or minus 1, then I'm solving y squared is 1 minus 1 is 0. So I only have one solution. So this is telling me something about my variety. This is something geometric. If I want to look at the points with fixed x coordinates, right, almost everywhere I have two y coordinates. But for some reason at the point z is 1 and z is minus 1, I only have one possible y coordinate. So what this means is that the curve described by this thing looks something like two lines that somehow cross over at one point. Right? If this is my x-coordinate and this is my y-coordinate, everywhere apart from these two points, I have two intersections. So the fact that I have this weird behavior, the fact that over an algebraically closed field, I always have n solutions of a degree n polynomial counted with multiplicity tells me that when I'm looking at the curve, in general, something like this is going to look like n different lines, but at some points they meet and they have weird intersection properties there. And you can say a lot about polynomial equations by studying the varieties that they generate. And you can say things about what the zeros look like based on the behavior of the varieties near these points. Yeah, so for geometry, we normally use algebraically closed fields for exactly the reason I said, because in algebraically closed fields, we can solve any polynomial. If we work with algebraically non-closed fields like R, some of our varieties end up being empty, some of our varieties just end up being more rubbish than they would if we looked at them with an algebraic closure. If you're a number theorist, though, not only will you frequently not work in algebraically closed fields, but you quite a lot of the time work in fields of non-zero characteristic. So all of my examples are Q and C have characteristic zero. You can never add one and get zero. But if you're working over a field with characteristic P, like Z over PZ, you can add one to itself P times it here and get zero. Working over fields with non-zero characteristic is truly the domain of number theorists. But one of the nice things about new advances in algebraic geometry is that it gives you the language to swap between fields. So here we sort of swapped from R into C and we got new behavior of our variety. But it's really difficult to swap from R into a field of characteristic P, like Z over PZ, and actually have something meaningful to say. But algebraic geometry has developed a new way to do that. And that's how you prove a lot of things, like how you prove Fermat's law set. You use techniques like this. Okay. So I'm going to rewrite this, actually. So I said the equation of a torus is y equals x cubed. What did I say it was? Y. Sorry. Y minus x cubed plus ax plus b. And I have to work over the complex numbers. And I claim that this gives me a torus. So why should this give us a torus? At first glance, it doesn't look like it really should. At second, third, and fourth glance, it really doesn't look like it should. The tricky thing about this is that we're looking inside C squared. C has two real dimensions, so C squared has four real dimensions, so I can't draw it. But what I can do is I can look at this equation in R squared and see what I get. So when I look at, because R is a one-dimensional subspace of C, R lives inside C is a one-dimensional thing, by looking at this equation over R instead of C, I'm really going to look at sort of slices of my torus, or slices of what my variety is. So this is what I started to do over here, but maybe. Something that looks like this. This is now working in class. So this is definitely going to be symmetric about the x-axis, so I'm not going to draw the x-axis in, because if y and x is a solution, then minus y and x is also going to be a solution, which is exactly what it means to be symmetric about the x-axis. So this is where we plug this equation for a is minus 1 and b is minus 1. When we plug in a is minus 1 is 0, we get something that looks like what we had before, but we also get a little circle over here. When we plug in a is minus 1, b is 1, we get some lumpy thing that looks like this. And when we plug in a zero, b is zero. We get something with a sharp point that looks like this. So why are these things tori? Well, you can think of this as if you take your torus, the torus that we all know and love, that looks like this. Well, if we draw a line on the torus, so I wasn't completely honest. I mean, I wasn't completely honest, but perhaps now it's catching up with me. When I said this was a torus, this is a torus minus one point. The reason we don't have, the reason we're missing a point is because the point really lives at infinity. Because this equation in this polynomial, instead of living in C squared, should really live in projective two space. I'll talk more about that later. But my point is, this is really a torus minus a point. So when we have a torus minus a point, we think of, we take the plane. We know that we can take r squared and add a point at infinity, glue everything together up at that point, and we get the sphere. That's something that we call the Riemann sphere. So the idea here is you're taking the plane, and you're gluing it up at the point. So at the point at infinity, so really the solution to this equation plus the point at infinity give me the torus. But when I draw it like this, I really need to have my point at infinity, not at infinity anymore. So, the slice I'm looking at for the green slice is going to be what happens if we look at this slice in the torus. We get something that looks like this. And if we take the point at infinity and we stretch everything off to infinity, we should get something that looks exactly like this. If I want to look at my pink slice, what should that be? Well, it should have infinity. It should do this. It should be the slice that looks like here. It goes over the top. It sort of dips down towards the middle. It goes over there. Comes back up underneath. Dips down again, and then comes back to where we started. So if I stretch this out to infinity, I can see that I have something that looks like most of a circle. So I have something that looks like a thing stretched out to infinity. So I have this long loop coming in from infinity, going down to going around a circle, and then coming back out to go back to infinity, which is what I drew down here. The lilac slice is going to be what I get if I just take the slice that looks like this, combined with the slice that looks like this. And then I really do get this circle here is this circle here, and this loop here is this loop here. And I can do a similar thing with the lavender thing. But this lavender thing is now, it has a sharp point. Now this is something that manifolds definitely don't do. Manifolds are smooth, that means exactly that they're not sharp. And yet this is definitely a variety, this is really just a slice of the torus. But it's a slice of the torus that isn't smooth. So this is another reason why variety is better than manifolds, is that you don't need them to be smooth. You can definitely have them be smooth and look at the smooth points, and that gives you something that corresponds more directly to a manifold. But you don't need the smoothness. You can draw things like this that have cusps, and they're still variety. And that's incredibly important for, important for looking at moduli problems. Because these whole things are really, these four different pictures are really just four different slices of the same object. So even though I can view the torus as a manifold, if I do that, not all of my slices are still manifolds, right? Because this slice is no longer a manifold. This slice, but it's still a variety. So if I want to look at the slices of an object, I really have to make sure I'm looking at varieties and not manifolds, otherwise my things won't be well defined. So that brings us rather nicely to the problem of moduli problems and smooth families of varieties. So I don't know the exact A and B values, but I know that you can choose them such that you can find something that looks like this. This is called a nodal curve. This is something that is most definitely not a manifold, right? Over here, and everywhere apart from this point, it's locally isomorphic to the real line, but at this point, it's isomorphic to two copies of the real line glued together. That's definitely not a manifold. And yet, why should I exclude this poor nodal curve from my consideration? There's nothing wrong with it. It just has this weird point. I should still be able to think of this as a geometric object. Certainly, I can picture this. Certainly, I can draw this down. Certainly, I want to be able to have a theory of geometry that includes this nodal curve. But manifolds won't do it. So this is exactly why I should look at varieties, because this is just another member of this same family. So if you only allow manifolds in your family, you end up with big gaps. And that really is frequently a problem when you're trying to solve moduli problems. So. So applications to moduli problems is really where algebraic geometry shines. So I keep saying the word moduli. Now I'm going to give a definition. So a moduli problem is where you have a family of objects and you're trying to realize that whole family as just a single geometric thing. So I'm going to write this down because there are some important things in the exact wording that I want to mention. So first of all, family. I mean, first of all, this definition is very vague. I would be very unhappy if I went to a lecture course and this was a definition that someone gave me, because I'd say, well, what you've just defined is nonsense. And you'd be right. But you'd be surprised how many books on moduli theory start with something almost exactly the same. So in particular, I haven't said what it means for a family of things, or what it means for a collection of things to be a family. I haven't said what my objects are. I haven't said what a geometric object is. I really haven't said very much other than written down some words. So a family of things is what you think it is. It's a collection of things that all sort of look the same, and you can think of them as you take things and then you squash them together, or you pull them apart, and then you get your family of objects. So we can view this collection of things as a family of objects. We can take this, we can pull it out. Once we pull it out far enough, we get this kink. We can pull it out some more, and then we end up pulling out so that it crosses over like this, and then we end up with this loop. We can pull it out, we can then stretch it up, we can pull this loop apart, and end up with something like this. Or we can just pull it apart even further, and end up with something like this. We can completely detach this circle here from the rest of the curve. So these really are just a family of objects that are very similar. They look quite different, but they've all got an equation defining them of almost exactly the same form, just with two constants changed. We can also think of families of circles. I mean, just take all the circles with different radii. They're definitely similar objects, just all elongated. So a family is really just exactly what you think of. But an object might not be. So I said a family of objects, and then I said a geometric object. My point here is that you don't have to start with geometric objects to end up solving your thing with a geometric object. You could solve it for some algebraic thing, some collection of polynomials, or some particular things inside your ring, and you can end up with a geometric object. So this is why I wanted to write it down, because you can start with something that's not geometric, and then make it into geometry. And that's always nice. So I'll give a few examples of multi-layer problems. In my first example, it's really important because what we end up, the moduli space. So maybe I should say a solution to a moduli problem is called a moduli space. It is the big object where the points of your big object correspond to each, to some member of your family of objects. Suppose I want to look at the curve. Suppose I want to look at the curve y equals 1 over x. This is a curve like this. We can definitely realize this as a manifold, but we really should think of both parts of this function together. If we realize it as a manifold, we'd sort of separate it into this bit, and we just end up with two lines, and that's kind of rubbish. When we think of this as a variety, these two things are really connected. This space, topologically, as a variety, is a connected space. There are no open subsets that separate this part from this part, even though that obviously are when you're looking at the Euclidean topology. So, this is y equals 1 over x. But now what if I want to look at the function y equals 2 over x? Suppose I want to look at the function y equals 1 over 2x. So what we end up with is we end up with this family of curves that end up getting squashed closer and closer to the x-axis. So what we're really doing is we're looking at the family of curves described by y equals a over x. But this is the same as saying x, y equals a. But since we're looking, here a is a constant, but since we're looking at the family, we're letting a vary. So instead of letting a constant vary, why don't we just call it a variable? And instead of looking at the family of solutions there, to the family of solutions to this, look at the single variety determined by x, y, and z. What does this look like? Well, if we fit z, the x, y coordinates of our thing should really just be exactly one of these curves. So if I go up to where z is 1, if I look at the slice where z is 1, really what I'm just getting is I'm getting this curve. Where this is just that picture rotated to fit over here. If I go up to where z is 2, I get the family that looks like this. But in fact, I know this is further from this point than this is from this point, exactly because this point is further from this point than this is from this point. I can play the same game with y equals a half. I can even say play the same game for negative. Right, and then I'd end up with families of curves in the other two quadrants. So what have I drawn? Well, I've really now drawn a surface. It's a surface that sort of looks like this. But as z gets closer and closer to 0, when z is 0, I'm just looking at the equation x, y is 0. So when z is 0, I'm really just looking at these two axes. So again, that corresponds on this picture to these two axes. So what that tells us is these two axes should really be thought of as lying inside this, as being part of the family of curves that look like this. But if we wanted to look at this family as, if we wanted to parameterize this as a manifold, we definitely couldn't, because these two lines aren't a manifold. So here's a moduli problem that you can solve with varieties just by writing this thing down, but you definitely can't solve with manifolds. So there we go. So I'd just like to finish by saying something about projective space and realizing projective space as the solution to a moduli problem. No introduction talk on algebraic geometry is ever complete without talking about either one of projective space or Bazouz's theorem. Bazouz's theorem gives you... Bazouz's theorem is some sort of topological thing that tells you when you take the intersection of varieties, what you get. The point is, when you try and intersect two manifolds, you don't always get a manifold. When you try and intersect two varieties, you always get two varieties. So this is one final way in which varieties are better than manifolds. Well, let's not dwell on it. And the fact that we can have Bazouz's theorem is really just the fact of the algebraic nature of this thing. But I decided to go for projective space instead, because projective space is much more geometric. So, take field K, take the vector space Kn plus 1, then what I want to do is I want to think about in Kn plus 1, I want to think about all the lines that go through the origin. So the lines that go through the origin in Kn plus 1, I want to try and solve the moduli problem, what is an object that parameterizes these lines? Well, how do we determine a line uniquely? What's the thing that determines a line in the vector space? Suggestions. What is a line? I'm sure you can draw one. So a line is just a direction, right? A general line, you pick a point, and then you travel in some direction from that point. So a line through the origin is just a set of all points on the same direction as this line, right? So a line is uniquely determined by its direction. Well, think of inside R2, any line is y equals ax plus b. So the lines that go through the origin have b as 0. So a line in R squared is just y equals ax. So there's an exact matchup between the lines in R squared and the elements of R, just by you pick that as a direction. So if I have a line in, I'm going to say given a line L in Kn plus 1, well, I'm going to write down its direction. I'm going to write down lambda 0, lambda 1, not this I can. Under n. So the line is the set of things that look like t times the vector lambda 0 up to lambda n. I've gone from 0 to n instead of 1 to n plus 1 for annoying technical reasons that we'll come to shortly. So this is the point on my, this is what my line looks like. L is the set of things like this, where t is in R, might be okay. So my line is exactly determined by this direction. But what happens if I scale this direction? What if I multiply this direction by 3? Do I change the line? No. That's the thing, it's still the same direction. So, really I don't want to distinguish between points that look like 1, 2, 3 and points that look like 2, 4, 6. Because these will be lines in R cubed that are both in the same direction. So now I'm going to define as a set projective n space to be the set of points x naught. And I'm going to not write them with commas, I'm going to write them with colons instead. And I'm not going to use soft brackets, I'm going to use hard brackets. This is what I'm going to define as a set, except I'm going to do an equivalence relation. I'm going to say two points are the same. Well, if given any anything in K, if I multiply all of my coordinates by the same thing. I'm going to say these are the same. So if you give me a line, I take the direction, and I just write down the direction like this. And the point is, it doesn't matter what multiple of the direction I choose, I still want to get the same point. So this is what projective space is, and we can give it a perfectly nice topology, because we can say, well, inside projective space, what about the points u0, where this point is in u0, exactly when x0 is not equal to 0. Right, I can't say what x0 is because it's only defined up to a constant multiple, but I can definitely say whether or not it's 0 because 0 multiplied by a non-zero thing is still 0. So if I look at points like this, I can write it all down as something that looks like this. So now these points are all unique. So really, u0 is as a set. It's just the same as an, because the point in u0 is exactly determined by what all of the other coordinates are after we divide through by n0. So this is projective space. I've said some things about the fact that it parameterizes lines, and more or less out of time, so reluctantly I'm not going to say some things about projective space that I want to say. But nonetheless, thank you very much for listening, and I hope